You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of June 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. Coming up on today's show, from Mariupol to Brussels to Baghdad and Brazil, we'll review the day's top news stories with Jane Kinnamont of Chatham House and Nina Schick of Open Europe right here in the studio. Then we'll meet the author of a new book which seeks to answer a question some of us will be asking, or possibly screaming, before this World Cup is over. How hard can it be to score a penalty?
In terms of the actual penalty itself, technique is probably about 20% of what would contribute to a successful penalty. Once you're good enough to play for your country, presumably technique is not a problem. It is all about the psychology of it.
And later in the show,
one does not make a wife of the rare and exotic.
Does she still have a tongue?
I have a tongue. Though yours explains well enough why I may not marry your son. My greatest misfortune would be to marry into a family who would carry me as their shame.
We'll be reviewing the latest film releases with the critic Tim Roby here in the studio. All that plus will be in Madrid, and we may even have some music. That's Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, coming up right now. An action-packed 60 minutes ahead of us then, but ahead of all that, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news.
Hundreds of people have been killed, many of them summarily executed, after Sunni Islamist militants overran the Iraqi city of Mosul. They're threatening to move in on the capital, Baghdad, but Iraqi government forces have carried out airstrikes to try and push back their advance. US President Barack Obama said he's also considering airstrikes to help Iraqi forces. Justin Marozzi is a historian and writer on the region. He said that the Iraqi Prime Minister may well need that help.
He has been sitting in Baghdad in smoke-filled rooms trying to cobble together a deal that will allow him to have a third term in power. Instead of actually reaching out to Sunnis and try to accommodate this very disaffected minority, he's been much more interested in regime survival. And he frankly has let the thing slip completely. It is out of control, and I think it's extremely hard to see how Maliki can get a way out of this without some sort of assistance.
Well, Iraqi Kurdish forces have taken advantage of the chaos to take control of the oil hub of Kirkuk. They've long campaigned for a separate state. Bayan Sami Abdul Rahman is the High Representative of Kurdistan here in the UK. He said the way to resolve the country's problems is to have one leader but split Iraq into different ethnic states.
Unfortunately, Prime Minister Maliki and other elements in Baghdad have not wanted that. They have wanted complete control. And this is where we've ended up. I think what's happening in Iraq today is partly as a result of the conflict in Syria being allowed to get out of control. Non-intervention in Syria by the international community has had terrible consequences.
Thailand's ruling military government has lifted a nationwide curfew today to bolster the country's vital tourism industry and promised to install an interim government in August. General Prayut Chan-o-cha, who heads the council that has overseen the country since taking over on the 22nd of May, said that power would be handed to the government by August. That, he said, was part of a three-phase plan of reconciliation, formation of a government and general elections. Ukrainian forces have retaken the rebel-held port city of Mariupol in a dawn attack launched as part of a broader military operation to reclaim control of eastern Ukraine. The rebel forces, who oppose the pro-European leadership in the capital, Kiev, and want to be part of Russia, said five of their fighters had been killed in that battle. Meanwhile, the European Union's energy chief, Gunther Oettinger, says that he hopes gas talks between Russia and Ukraine to resolve a price dispute will continue this weekend.
It's my intention to continue with negotiations. There was an arrangement, an agreement to say yes, we are willing from all sides, and so my hope is that we can continue tomorrow in a trilateral manner.
The Colombian president Juan Manuel Santos has called on voters to give peace a chance during a very tight presidential campaign in the South American nation. He began peace talks with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, the FARC, in 2012. Leading opposition candidate Oscar Iván Zuluaga edged out President Juan Manuel Santos in the 25th of May first round election, sending the country up for a very tight runoff this Sunday. And finally, there was something old, something new, something borrowed and something double-ply for 10 designers who battled it out for $10,000 and the top prize in the 10th annual Lavatory Paper Wedding Dress Contest held in New York City. The elaborate gowns, headpieces, purses and lacy veils showed off at the competition had to be made of rolls of Charmin ultra-soft toilet paper, according to the organisers of the event, cheapchicweddings.com. And that story ends this bulletin of Monocle 24 News.
Thank you, Jonathan. And if we ever stop making wedding dresses out of toilet paper, then the terrorists will have won. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We'll be back right after this.
Vanuit London. Dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres. Essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London. This is Monocle 24.
Orlando, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Orlando.
London, London으로부터
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06. It's 13.06 in New York. Joining me now with their take on today's news here in the studio, we have Jane Kinnan-Mont, Senior Research Fellow and Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and also Nina Schick from the EU policy think tank Open Europe. We will start in Ukraine, where reports suggest that Ukrainian forces have retaken the port of Mariupol on the Sea of Azov near Russia's border. Mariupol has changed hands several times in the last few weeks. As of earlier today, however, Ukraine's Interior Minister Arsen Avakov announced that the Ukrainian flag was raised over Mariupol's city hall. Nina, I'll ask you first, is it likely to stay there this time?
Well, I think that despite all the overtures that we've seen by leaders in the last few days, that tension seems to be calming down. Ukraine remains very much a simmering tinderbox. So let's see what happens. I mean, the Ukrainian authorities have said that Russian tanks were clearly again in the eastern regions of Ukraine. They've denied that, but fundamentally, Russia still hasn't pulled back its troops from the Ukrainian border. And these separatists, which Kiev claims are sponsored by the Kremlin, are still making incursions into eastern Ukraine. And that will be the big test now facing the new president of Ukraine, Poroshenko, to see whether or not they can have some kind of a deal or negotiation with Putin.
The tank story was weird because they were clearly there and they did clearly look very much like Russian tanks, while Russia denied that they were Russian tanks, but it was extremely difficult to imagine where else they could have come from.
Yes. Yeah.
An awful lot of this pseudo-conflict has been smoke and mirrors to the point where, and Jane, I'll ask you this, this is just, have we actually now reached a weird sort of interregnum in which Ukraine and Russia are actually kind of on the same side in that they both want this scaled back short of civil war?
Well, I think that's right. There's a focus now on whether there can be politics means rather than more severe conflict. And there's been some discussion over whether Ukraine might agree to buy Russian gas at favourable prices.
They have offered a compromise price, I think, $326 per 1,000 cubic metres, for all the sense this makes to me, yeah, as opposed to the $485 Russia was asking. Is that basically what this has been about all along?
It does make you rather cynical, does it not?
It really does. On which subject? Poroshenko and Putin spoke at Normandy. They have spoken again over the phone, apparently, about these tanks and where else they could possibly have come from but Russia. Nina, is it possible that these two men have basically decided between them, OK, enough's enough, and that some slightly shabby deal has been done whereby Ukraine buys Russia's gas, Russia keeps Crimea, and leaves Ukraine to its own devices?
Well, interestingly, Ukraine has said that it rejects the price that Russia has put forward, because after Russia took Crimea, it hiked its gas prices to Ukraine by 80%. And this deal that they're offering now is a mere hike of 60%. So interestingly, Ukrainian leaders have come out today saying that the population should prepare for gas shortages. And ultimately, this is to do with economics, I think, because fundamentally, Russia has already lost the prize because Russia was hoping to envelop Ukraine into its Eurasian customs union. Now, Ukraine is in negotiations and ready to sign a closer trade association with the EU. That's still ongoing, but they hope to sign that later this year. So Russia has decided that despite this, it will still move ahead with its own Eurasian Customs Union. But without Ukraine, it'll be footing 80% of the bill. So Russia has lost the big prize already, Ukraine.
Russia hasn't done too badly, though. It is Crimea the richer for this enterprise. Is there, Jane Kinnaman, is there anything left in Ukraine that Russia really wants?
Well, it's partly now in a battle of wills with the West, and it's partly trying to show its muscle in the face of the EU. But that kind of grandstanding has backfired. It's been essentially excluded from the G8. It's had sanctions to some extent put on it, so it's in a difficult position. But it is Putin is a very nationalistic and proud leader. He will have concerns about losing face.
But the G8 thing will, I mean, it'll be temporary. They can't keep Russia in the doghouse forever.
That's right. But this, remember, is the year that Russia had the G8 presidency. It was supposed to be yet another chance for Putin to posture internationally following the success of the Winter Olympics. He was going to theme it around migration and be showing himself a leader on an issue of global importance. And none of that's happening.
If we are going to proceed on the optimistic assumption that this is all simmering down a little bit, Nina, has this been ultimately a victory for Vladimir Putin?
Oh, absolutely, because he got Crimea. And it's interesting to note that when Poroshenko took office, he made a distinct statement that Crimea belonged to Ukraine and that they would try to get it back. But still,
he kind of had to say that.
Well, obviously. But in the long term, Russia is, I would say, the weaker partner, because if you look at their economy, they're far too dependent on exports of energy. They have a horrible demographic crisis looming. And also, because of the political uncertainty that's realized around the entire Ukraine crisis, we've been seeing tremendous amounts of capital flight from Russia. So effectively, even though the EU sanctions on Russia weren't that dire, Russia effectively sanctioned itself. Now, interestingly, the EU hasn't been taking such a hard line on Russia. And just earlier this week, yesterday, in fact, the foreign ministers of Poland and Germany were in Russia having talks with the Russian foreign minister. And that's because they're uncomfortable bedfellows. They still rely on each other very much for economic reasons. I mean, the EU is still Russia's biggest trading partner.
But has there been a kind of, as well as the seizure of Crimea, I'm just wondering if there's a diplomatic or strategic prize here for Russia, in that the same way meddling in Georgia in 2008, that would have been, whenever that was, something like that. That punted the idea of Georgia being a member of NATO into the long grass for a generation. Has this done the same for Ukraine, Jane?
I think it's shown some limitations of the EU's commitment to actually defend its ally Ukraine, and I think it's problematic from that point of view. I think it's shaken confidence in the EU and in the US as allies.
Well, EU leaders have been very clear, saying that Ukraine, they do not foresee membership of NATO for Ukraine in the next 10 years or so. So if Putin's goal was to ensure that Ukraine doesn't become an EU member state, then I would say, yes, he's been successful. However, where he hasn't been successful is preventing Ukraine from signing this trade association with the EU, which is the reason why the protests in Kiev started in the very first place.
It is amazing to think that that was what they were originally about, that it wasn't all that long ago. Room, perhaps, then, for some optimism about Ukraine, rather less so about Iraq. The extraordinary blitz across the northwest of the country by the Islamist militants of ISIL continues, with two more towns in Diyala province falling. Reports from inside the now ISIL-held areas and videos and press releases issued by ISIL themselves suggest that atrocities are being committed against captured troops and civilians alike. Jane, I'll ask you first, is it possible, especially in the light of Barack Obama's remarks about an hour ago, which we will come to, is it possible at all to see how Iraq can roll this back without outside assistance?
It's possible, but unlikely. Remember, a few years ago, Iraq had great success in fighting al-Qaeda-linked militias because Sunni tribespeople turned against them. Many, many Sunnis in Iraq are not supported. Most Sunnis are not
indeed
supporters
not,
of Al-Qaeda. But it's got to the point that the sectarian policies of Maliki's government mean that for many Sunnis, these guys are the lesser of two evils.
It is worth remembering that a great many of the hundreds of thousands of people that have fled Mosul and to Crete in the last few days would be Sunnis who are no keener on living under ISIL than anybody else.
Absolutely, and who would prefer to live in the Kurdistan region if they can get there, but it's increasingly difficult to get out. It used to be, again, in the past, people would flee Iraq for Syria. That's no longer an option.
Nina Sheikh, Barack Obama, speaking about an hour ago, did talk about the idea of possible US assistance. The idea of American airstrikes against ISIL on behalf of Baghdad has been floated. Is that going to help? And two, how does Barack Obama even begin to try selling that to the American people?
I think Barack Obama has no chance of selling that to the American people, to be honest. We've seen lots of fatigue across the Western world of getting embroiled in these type of conflicts in the Middle East. However, I think the only... And I think Jane will agree with me when I say that it probably will get worse before it gets better. And ultimately, the only way this can have a hope of being resolved is if the regime in Baghdad tries to integrate the Sunnis back into society. Because fundamentally, this has a lot to do with the Sunnis being isolated, not only the Sunnis, but also the Kurds by a Shia majority government.
Barack Obama did also suggest to the leaders of Iraq that they set aside their sectarian differences, which I guess it's the kind of thing he has to say, but you can't imagine that happening anytime soon, can you?
Well, what we've been seeing is a politicization of the Iraqi security forces when a lot of, during 2007 and 2008, a lot of Sunnis were fighting in the Iraqi army. And at that point, Al-Qaeda was almost wiped out in Iraq. However, since 2008, the regime has slowly been replacing Sunnis and Kurds from the army with Shia. So this is seems to me more to do with the security of Baghdad and the regime protecting itself rather than to do with the security of Iraq as a country.
One of the most worrying signs is the presence of Iranian Revolutionary Guards. One of the senior leaders, Qasem Soleimani, has been in Baghdad this week. Maliki's government can see that Iran helped to tip the balance for Assad in Syria against the opposition there. He clearly wants to do the same thing, but that is going to provoke Sunnis even further. They're afraid of being dominated by Iran.
There is, of course, a long and glorious history of people sitting in offices in Britain drawing lines on the map of the Middle East, which brings us to the question of whether, and this is far from a minority opinion at this point. Ali Alawi, the former Prime Minister of Iraq, has floated this as a live possibility. Which is the breakup of Iraq, would that necessarily be a bad thing?
It would necessitate a lot of ethnic cleansing. The capital, Baghdad, is still very mixed. It does have sectarianised neighbourhoods, but there is a great attachment from Sunni and Shia communities to Baghdad. So you would have to see very large population and refugee flows. It is, though, something that is very much on the cards.
And Nina Sheikh, I guess to ask you the same question in reverse, can Iraq be held together at this point?
Well, I think that fundamentally there has to be some kind of integration of the ethnic groups of the Sunni group and the Kurds as well. An interesting thing about ISIS that's maybe worth pointing out is that they are far more inclusionary than Al-Qaeda was. So they're reaching out to non-Arabs as well to join their forces. And a lot of Westerners are fighting in their forces. So apart from this being a threat to...
Heartwarming.
I know. Apart from this being a threat to the Middle East, there's a fear that... A lot of these fighters will come back to Europe and also do attacks in Europe, which indeed already has happened. An ISIS fighter did a shooting in a Jewish museum in Belgium last month. So that's another thing that will be playing on the minds of Western officials as they watch this meteoric rise of ISIS.
We have seen one of the more peculiar subplots of the last 96 extremely peculiar hours is that the only military force in Iraq which seems willing or able to stand up to ISIL stroke ISIS is the Kurdish Peshmerga, who are now consolidating in Kirkuk and surrounds, obviously a very contested and not coincidentally very oil-rich part of Iraq. Again, the question has to be asked, is Iraq's crisis Kurdistan's opportunity? Jane, I will put that to you first.
Well, it's a time that the Kurds feel that they are rising in the region, and Kurdistan has some autonomy already. It's got very strong economic ties with Turkey. The leaders of Iraqi Kurdistan are very influential in the Syrian Kurdish populations. They see themselves as having a time of opportunity. But of course, they're also very worried. There have been explosions in the northern Iraq Kurdish region recently, which has only happened, I think, on two or three occasions since 2003.
Nina Sheikh, regarding this shambles from Kurdistan's perspective, is there anything to be gained by Kurdistan from staying in Iraq at this point?
Well, this is the fear why this could just escalate into a spiral if there is an integration of the Sunni groups and the Kurdish groups. And in fact, if the army now starts, which is a big risk, starts attacking and it's attacking Sunni young men who aren't radicalized, then that could further, or Kurdish young men, then that could further perpetuate the cycle of violence. So we won't be seeing then any peaceful outcome anytime soon.
But in the short term, the Kurds don't have the oil flowing yet. They need to get the oil up and running. They need to get their pipelines into Turkey up and running. Right now, they actually depend on Baghdad transferring a share of the national oil revenues to them. So they could be in for a tricky few months.
Okay, well, we'll take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller. Jane and Nina will be here when we come back. Up next, we'll be looking at the ongoing wrangle over who will be the next president of the European Commission.
24/7, 28 programmes, up to 10 hours of speech a day. There's a glorious feast of Monocle 24 to savour. But when you want a slimming digest, fear not, we've got the curator. Premiering every Saturday and downloadable via monocle.com and at iTunes, it's a weekly roundup of the best from the week that was. Hours of audio output distilled into 1 hour of selected interviews, quirky dispatches and journalistic coups. Plus, here again, from the entrepreneurs, urbanists, architects, artists and culinary masterminds who made Monocle 24 special over the past 7 days. That's The Curator, here on Monocle 24, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me is Jane Kinnunmont from Chatham House and Nina Sheikh from Open Europe. We'll look now at the diplomatic spat, which has, against little competition for the title, made Jean-Claude Juncker the most famous Luxembourger who ever lived. The former prime minister of the tiny country is favoured by most of the next president of the European Commission. German Chancellor Angela Merkel is a particular fan. However, Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron is strenuously objecting to Juncker's instalment. Nina Sheikh, I'll ask you first, are Angela Merkel and David Cameron literally the only two people in Europe who care about this?
No, I mean, this is actually a travesty because according to the EU treaties, the European Commission has to be appointed by the European Council. That's where the heads of the European member states sit. Now, the European Parliament went into the European parliamentary elections this year campaigning, saying that the lead candidates of the main groups in the European Parliament should automatically become the president of the next commission. Now, the party that won, the EPP, their lead candidate was Jean-Claude Juncker. Unfortunately, nobody in Europe even knows who this man is. Only 8 to 10% of him can identify him on a good day. To put that into perspective, more
8 to 10%. I'm doubting that.
Yes?
Yeah, can't imagine it's that high. I'm serious. I really, really can't.
So let's put that into perspective. More Europeans were conceived in an IKEA bed than can identify who Jean-Claude Juncker is. So
the same bed, presumably.
Not the same bed. So the argument that Jean-Claude Juncker is somehow the epitome of democracy and that the European masses rose up to elect him as their president is just utter rubbish. Now, David Cameron, interestingly, couldn't say that Juncker should be the man for the job because he wasn't on a single ballot paper across Europe. Nobody, 99% of the people here in Britain don't know who he is.
Again, I think you're underestimating that number grievously.
The 1% is lying. And although Merkel has publicly said she backs Juncker, it's a lot more complicated than that because privately, Merkel doesn't back Juncker as Commission President either. However, this has to do with domestic politics in Germany because her coalition partners have said to her, if she doesn't back Juncker, then she's standing in the way of EU democracy and pandering to the ever-troublesome EU partner, that is Great Britain. So then Merkel had to, there was such a vociferous campaign for Juncker in Germany on the principle of democracy that Merkel then came out and said that she backed Juncker. But that took a few days. It took her a while to change her position.
Jane Kinnunmont, why is David Cameron, do you think, investing such political energy in this argument when, as Nina has pointed out, there cannot be one British person in a thousand who would recognise Juncker if he sat next to them on the bus?
Cameron has sought to emphasise that it's not a personal issue with Juncker, but this is ultimately an issue about the rights of EU member states and their elected leaders to choose this leader rather than this the new system that's been instated. So it is part of his drive to limit the powers of Europe and to stand against the shift towards greater political and economic integration.
Also at a time when the impetus for reform across Europe couldn't be stronger. I mean, you just need to look at the results of the European parliamentary elections where 31% of the seats were swept out by anti-establishment parties.
It was a fairly passive-aggressive result all round on the part of the European electorate.
Yeah. Yes. So the people are saying we want reform. We want to change the way Europe is run. So if Juncker became the president of the Commission, he's the very epitome of arch federalist, old European elite that the people have said they do not want. So that's the reason why Cameron has to make a stand against Juncker.
OK, well, finally, as we count down the hours until the commencement of Australia's march to glory against Chile later this evening, we should take a look at the World Cup. Mexico won, Cameroon nil, incidentally. The tournament has kicked off against a backdrop of protest on the streets of Brazil and a gathering scandal around the awarding of the 2022 World Cup to Qatar, as if anything funny could possibly have been going on in awarding it to a bottomlessly rich country which might have been scientifically designed as a place where you can't play football. Jane, first of all, they're being called mega events, and are they overreaching themselves? Brazil has spent a fantastic amount of money on this, $11.3 billion or something. Russia spent more on the Sochi Winter Olympics than every other Winter Olympics combined. And there is gathering protest against it. Are they becoming absurd at this point?
Clearly, they're a double-edged sword because the media spotlight that you get when you host a big event also encourages every other opposition force
Indeed.
In your country to use that.
Yeah, the good news is everybody pays attention to you. The bad news is everybody pays attention to you.
Absolutely. We see it every year in one of the countries that I cover, Bahrain, which is the smallest country in the Arab world. There's a protest movement there that's still going 3 years on, but rarely makes headlines. Every year the Formula One comes to town, the opposition use it as a platform for protest. The government use it as a platform for PR. Violence becomes worse around the Formula One. It's fascinating that sometimes very small countries as well want to go for these big events. Qatar may be extremely rich, but it has 250,000 citizens, and their entire economy has become geared to building the World Cup infrastructure. One wonders what's going to happen in 2023 when nobody comes.
I'm not sure I'd be betting all that much on anything happening in 2022 at this point, frankly, because we have now reached the point at which the sponsors are expressing reluctance about being associated with something that people are taking a dim view of, especially Adidas and Coke. Nina Schick, do countries sign up for these things because, apart from the sort of domestic bread and circuses aspect of it, there's a perception that it makes them look like grown-ups, like players, that it has genuine soft power cachet, as it were. Does it at this point, in a sort of an increasingly media-literate world in which everybody can see through this, which everybody can react instantly online, does it still have the same mystique that it once did, hosting a World Cup or an Olympics?
I think that if it can be still very glorious, we just need to look at the Olympics in London. However, I think that when sports crosses over into politics, that's when it gets messy. And that's exactly what we're seeing in Brazil right now. And when you have a situation like you do in Brazil, where one of the stadiums is up the Amazon and they spend $250 million building this stadium that will host four matches, that really is a waste of resources when you have a country that's still very troubled economically, and that's what we've seen in the protests.
The one statistic that just strikes me as absolutely incredible, given that you would think, from a domestic political point of view, the easiest sell you could ever possibly make would be to convince the people of Brazil that a World Cup would be a great thing. You'd think this is not complicated. 60% of Brazilians think this is bad for Brazil. I guess, and I'll ask you each this question, how important important for Brazil's domestic leadership is it that Brazil actually win this thing, Jane?
The start of last night's match will have been pretty depressing for Rousseff.
I mean, seriously, how rickety does she end up looking if it's Argentina who are lifting this trophy a few weeks from now?
Yeah, I think that probably will have a deciding factor in how the public view this World Cup, the Brazilian public.
We will have to leave it there. Time is against us. Jane Kinnenmont and Nina Schick, thank you both very much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost, se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
Plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll head to Madrid. We'll meet the author of 12 Yards, The Art and Psychology of the Perfect Penalty, which may be useful reading for a few people. And we'll talk film with Tim Robey. But ahead of all that, Jonathan Wheatley has the headlines.
Thank you very much. Hundreds of people have been killed, many of them summarily executed after Sunni Islamist militants overran the Iraqi city of Mosul. They're threatening to move in on the capital, Baghdad. Iraqi Kurdish forces have taken advantage of the chaos to take control of the oil hub of Kirkuk. Thailand's ruling military government has lifted a nationwide curfew on Friday to bolster the country's vital tourism industry and promised to install an interim government by August. Ukrainian forces have retaken the rebel-held port city of Mariupol in a dawn attack launched as part of a broader military operation to reclaim control of eastern Ukraine. And the Colombian president Juan Manuel Santos has called on voters to give peace a chance during a tight presidential campaign in the South American nation. The election, the second round, is on Sunday. And that's the news here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Welcome back to Midori House. You're live here on Monocle 24. It's 21:32, near enough, in Moscow. That'll be 18:32 in London, 14:32 in Rio de Janeiro, very near which, well, in the same country as Mexico, are still leading Cameroon 1-0. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the world. Today we're heading to Madrid, where Liam Aldous awaits, I'm sure, clad like I am in his Socceroos shirt, waiting for kickoff against Chile. Liam, welcome to the programme.
Hey, thank you. I'm actually wearing La Roja, the red shirt. I've traded sides. Sorry to abandon you there, Andrew.
That's a bit treacherous, Liam. I mean, I know we're in a tough group, but really, you've got to have a bit of faith, don't you?
Well, I just want a chance at least winning a cup. Australia's is in it to win it, but I just think Spain has a better chance. I'm just being realistic.
Dear, oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. I've got a good mind to cancel this segment right here in a fit of pious patriotic disgust, but then it would just be me talking about what I had for lunch for the next 6 minutes. So we won't do that. We will talk about things happening in Spain. I guess that the abdication of the king is still going to be big news, isn't it?
It is indeed, and it's kind of interesting because Spain is suddenly talking about whether it should be a republic, what the relevance of the monarchy is, even though it's been having that kind of tepid debate every time the king who just recently abdicated has kind of slipped up. Those kind of debates have kind of reached into the press. But it's interesting this week because it's kind of a gift to Republicans because the whole conversation has been about what the king's legal protection will be after he abdicates. And just to put it into perspective, when the king announced his abdication, there actually wasn't a law in the Constitution which talked about abdication. So they had to rush through a law to allow him to abdicate. So it's kind of I'm launching into a stereotype here, but it's a very Spanish way of doing things, just to leave it until tomorrow and sort it out later. They sorted out the abdication. So that law was actually passed with 91% of the parliament passing the law. But now they're talking about whether he will have legal protection, because at the moment he's inviolable as far as the law is concerned. And once he renounces the throne, he won't have legal protection from things such as paternity suits, which is a very interesting inclusion in the amount of protections he'll have.
So that aside, how much trouble could a retired king possibly find himself in?
Well, if you go back to the scandal embroiling his daughter and his son-in-law about a corruption scandal which involved the siphoning off of public funds for fake contracts, and that's still in the courts at the moment, there was a very questionable loan given from the king to his daughter, which has basically been untouchable as far as the courts have been concerned, but may actually become part of the case. So there's talk that he will be given complete legal protection and be made one of the aforados. Now, the aforados in Spain are actually a group of about 10,000 politicians, magistrates, and public officials that have a special legal protection, which means that any crime they commit or any offence that is taken to the courts has to be tried in the Supreme Court. So he's going to be given extra special aforado status.
Now, I understand that Juan Carlos is not the only high-profile Spaniard handing in his cards.
No, I think this is a very interesting turn of events in Spain. People always say in Spain that no one ever quits. It's a typical slogan you hear that people, a politician can be embroiled or even on trial for corruption and still hold his post. But suddenly this theory is being put into test with this avalanche of resignations. The first most high-profile one was Alfredo Rubalcaba, who's actually the socialist opposition leader, and he quit the day after the European elections, which basically the socialists lost half of their vote. So now there's a lot of talk about who's going to be the opposition leader. And the front runner is Eduardo Medina, who, funnily enough, looks like a younger version of, a beardless version of Rajoy, which takes me back to my Australian past when Kevin Rudd and John Howard went up against each other, and Kevin Rudd looked like a younger version of John Howard and actually won. So the election in 2015 could be an interesting one.
And finally, we do need to move along to the World Cup as a sort of curtain raiser for the important game later on this evening between Australia and Chile, that there is some sort of warm-up between Spain and the Netherlands.
Yeah, well, everyone's talking. There's a lot of pressure, obviously, on the Spanish team. Obviously, they've got to defend their title. And Holland was actually the Netherlands was actually a very, very good competitor last tournament. So they're not going to underestimate them. There's been a lot of talk about
this is a replay of the last final, in fact.
Exactly. So obviously, it's kind of we'll see if history repeats itself and they win. But everyone will the whole country will stop. Well, everyone will stop talking about the king and all politics. And it's kind of interesting to walk around the capital when any big football game is on. You actually don't even have to own a television. You just walk through the street and you can hear when a goal is scored. There's TV screens pretty much in every window. It's kind of good. I don't own a TV, so I just take a walk around the street to watch the game.
And so, will you be watching it, or will you be walking the streets hoping to get an idea from the noise coming out of windows?
I'll be doing a bit of both. I'll be going to a traditional Spanish bar and living the passion live with a few friends and a few vermouths, as I like to drink when I watch football games.
And for Australia's triumph over Chile?
Well, that's at midnight, so it depends on how my night turns. I'll stay and watch Australia's triumph, and I'll send you a message if they win, Andrew, and maybe we can enjoy some fellow Australian patriotism together. But I'm not sure if that's going to happen.
I'm insanely confident. Actually, in these circumstances, that is kind of a tautology. Liam Algis in Madrid, thank you very much for joining us. Up next, we'll be meeting the author of 12 Yards: The Art and Psychology of the Perfect Penalty.
The Entrepreneur seeks out the seers, the sages, and the successes of the business world. Every week, we take you on an hour-long tour to uncover the hidden, extraordinary, curious, and inspiring stories you won't hear anywhere else.
I don't see any borders between countries, if it's in Japan, England, France. My approach is that I believe that people anywhere in the world, there are people who understand and appreciate it.
There's a push maybe that people want to have more of their stuff made locally because they know where it's coming from.
From the kiosk owners of Cairo to the coffee culture of Tel Aviv, from the beer brewers of Ghana to the piano makers of Greece. Intrigued? Well, tune in to hear how the best entrepreneurial minds tick, not just the ups and downs of the FTSE.
We didn't buy into a design studio or a commercial entity, we bought into a factory.
So, if you have an idea and want to drop that 9-to-5, you've just found your new business Bible.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Pictet.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still Mexico 1, Cameroon 0. And also in the spirit of the World Cup, here are some great footballing names. Roberto Baggio, Didier Seeks, Chris Waddle, Asamo Gyan, Michel Platini. Great names indeed, but in many cases more notorious for a certain high-profile failure. All these men were highly paid, highly regarded professional footballers who at least once in their lives proved unable to hit a target 8 yards wide from a distance of 12 yards. The inability of certain players, teams, even entire nations to convert the high-pressure penalty kick has become the stuff of legend. In his new book, 12 Yards, The Art and Psychology of the Perfect Penalty, Ben Littleton examines this unique piece of sporting theatre. He stopped by Midori House to talk to Monocle's Tom Edwards about exactly what certain serial offenders, England and the Netherlands should take particular note, need to do to transform their fortunes from the spot. Tom began by asking if this is a sporting book or a book about psychology.
In terms of the actual penalty itself, technique is probably about 20% of what would contribute to a successful penalty at the level of a World Cup, because once you're good enough to play for your country, presumably technique is not a problem. So from that point of view, it is all about the psychology of it. But I'm a sports writer by background. I'm not a trained psychologist nor a psychological writer. So it's written as a sports book with a psychological element to it, I would say.
And as you spoke to people then, both experts in psychology, experts in penalty taking in many cases, lots of the heroes, the legends of the dark art, I wonder whether you found that there were key things that people kept mentioning to you. There are obviously sort of themes that run through the book. Was there something that bound the personalities together? Because there's always this impression to some that, oh, you know, the Maverick is well suited to taking penalties. It's all about him. It's all about ego. Does that stand true? Because, or is it actually, there's any kind of characters who can be well suited to taking penalties?
I can break it down into two answers, Tom. One, in terms of goalkeepers, I really felt that goalkeepers who take penalties were all really eccentric, slightly crazy, because one of the pioneers of that art was José Luis Chilavert, the Paraguayan goalkeeper from the 80s and early 90s, who scored 63 penalties. And I spoke to him, and I was very surprised that he wasn't mad or crazy or eccentric. And he said it was all an act, and he was actually very deliberate and considered. And he explained to me why that was. For a start, to be a goalkeeper and take penalties, you have to be better than the strikers. So in a way, you have to work harder, prove yourself more. And for the coach to trust the goalkeeper to take penalties is a huge risk. So you have to have the trust of your coach as well. So in terms of personality types, I was expecting to find goalkeepers being crazy. And I spoke to Ricardo, who said the same thing, and Hans-Jörg Butt, who scored three penalties in the Champions League, all against Juventus. And he was probably the emblem of them all. He was the most serious, most professional. And I was like, yeah, but you're a goalkeeper. You must be a bit crazy. No, I am really not. And he really, really wasn't. So that was one kind of myth that kind of exploded in my face. And in terms of general penalty takers, I met a German psychologist who did loads of studies on personality types. And he had 80 people come to Leipzig to do a day of penalty taking. And he also gave them a thorough questionnaire assessing their own personalities, because he felt that the extrovert guys would be the best. Well, it wasn't the extrovert guys that won that competition. And it wasn't really the best players that won it either, because of these 80 players, some were from Germany's second division and some played in Germany's eighth division, all the way down the leagues. And it was a player from the sixth division who proved to be the best penalty taker. So it wasn't really about ability. When you think of the big players that have missed penalties, Maradona missed 5 in a row, Baggio missed in the World Cup final when he was best player in the world, Messi and Ronaldo have missed in Champions League semi-finals. So it wasn't really about ability either. What he found it was about was competition anxiety and how you perform under pressure. And that brings us back to 2006 and the Italy-France World Cup final, when Italy had one kick to win the tournament and Marcello Lippi, the coach, had to decide who was going to take it. He would have chosen Francesco Totti, but Totti had gone off during the game. So he had one option left, and he could have chosen Cannavaro, who was the captain, best player on the side. He could have chosen two of his strikers, Luca Toni or Iaquinta, both on the pitch, had both scored in the tournament. And he could have chosen Gattuso or Nesta, two players who had won Champions Leagues at Milan. He didn't go for any of those guys. He chose the left back, Fabio Grosso, who who'd only taken one penalty before in his career, 5 years earlier in Italy's third division. And the reason he chose him was because he felt he would react best in that pressure. He had the least anxiety about the competition. And possibly it was because of his status as a lowly left back. He had less far to fall. And you think of the players that have missed big penalties, they're the best players in the world. Often the pressure of that status does affect the players at that moment.
Now, you speak to lots of sort of penalty heroes in the book, and there's a few that really sort of jump out the pages. One that struck me was when you talked, we hear from Andrea Pirlo, and he describes one of the moments when he takes his penalty, just incredible language. And I wondered whether there's another fundamental problem with English players, that they would just never come out with some of the sort of insights that you get. He talks about, even if I'd missed, the teachings I'd learned about what it was to be Italian would be there. I say the tepid shiver I felt before scoring was the truest feeling I've ever felt in my life. I can't imagine any English player, this could be unfair, coming out talking in such sort of poetic terms. Is there do we have a failure to engage with the game on this sort of spiritual? Oftentimes you talk in the book about comparisons with great literature and theatre. Do we fail to engage with the game on that level? Is that another weakness, do you think, in the English psyche?
I don't think so. I mean, I think Andrea Pirlo, that quote's from his book, by the way, which is amazing. And I think he writes like he plays in a very lyrical and creative way. But I don't really think intelligence plays a role. In fact, studies in golf suggest that if you overthink your moment of one shot is all it takes, if you think too much in that walk to the spot, you're more likely to fail.
Do you think England have taken messages on board? Could we see England even beating anybody in a penalty shootout?
Well, they might be Holland in a penalty shootout. I mean, the one reason for optimism, well, there are two really. One is that we have a lot of penalty takers in the squad. And in fact, if you look at the breakdown of every World Cup squad, England's is the only squad with at least five players who've taken more than three penalties this season. So there is something in having regular penalty takers available. And even though, yes, some regular penalty takers have missed for England, if you look at the players in the whole who've missed, they've been non-regular takers. Southgate, Waddle, Batty, Ince, Carragher, Young, Cole. So it's more often than not the non-regular guys. But we have Lampard, Gerrard, Lambert, Baines and Rooney, who've all taken at least three penalties this season. Now, they might not all be on the pitch at any given time. But having them in the squad, I think, does give me some confidence. And the other thing is, I think England are taking it seriously. Roy Hodgson has called it a negative obsession and tried to dampen down talk of it, which doesn't do me any favours. But they are taking Steve Peters to Brazil with them, and I think that can only have a positive impact when you look at the work he's done with Liverpool, and to actually treat it seriously and say you need a psychologist to help you with this one moment, because it is essentially the moment that can make or break your whole career. There's a France player, Didier Cisse, who missed a penalty in 1982 in the first World Cup shootout. And he said that his whole career has been marked by that miss. Not only was he made the scapegoat of the defeat and ushered out of the France reckoning, but when he applied for coaching jobs, people in France assumed he was mentally weak because he missed a penalty in one game. And therefore, he never got coaching jobs in France as a result of it. So it can really haunt you for the rest of your life. It's a moment of vulnerability. And in a way, for many players, your whole career as a footballer builds up to this moment. So we enjoy it as drama, but it's obviously, you know, the stakes are huge for these individuals. And I think to have someone like Steve Peters there to guide the players through it, I think can only be a good thing.
And that was Ben Littleton, author of 12 Yards, The Art and Psychology of the Perfect Penalty, out now, published by Bantam. He was speaking to Tom Edwards. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 1848 here in London.
At the 2014 World Cup in Brazil, these are something we'll be hearing a lot of over the 4 weeks of the tournament. But what are the alternative national songs that bind the nations taking part in the World Cup together?
There is one song that every South Korean knows, and that is the old folk song Arirang.
We can dissent with our country, but we can be patriotic while doing it.
Monocle 24 brings you a series of special reports on the unofficial anthems that capture the spirit of the 32 nations battling it out in Brazil.
When people come out with some Advance Australia Fair, everybody kind of looks at each other and thinks, what country is that? Whereas if it's Waltzing Matilda, no problem. Waltzing Matilda
with me. That's the World Cup's alternative national anthems throughout the World Cup here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's 18:50 here in London, still Mexico 1, Cameroon 0 as they approach injury time. It's time now to review the best, occasionally the worst, in the world of the arts. Today it's Friday, so we're talking cinema, and joining me now to do exactly that is the film critic Tim Robey. Tim, welcome back to the programme.
Thank you.
The first film you want to talk about tonight, Devil's Knot. It's about the West Memphis Three, and I guess the thing it was always going to struggle against is that the West Memphis Three's tale has been told and told and told in a couple of particularly very, very good documentaries.
Yeah, it has. There have been like at least four really excellent documentaries about this case already. So what can Atom Egoyan do with his film? What can he tell us that we don't already know? He can't really, but what he can do is he can kind of fashion it as a contemporary version of The Crucible, basically. So the situation is these three boys were brutally murdered and left in a kind of gully in Arkansas. And then three goth teenagers were arrested and tried and imprisoned for this crime.
The usual suspects were rounded up.
They were, because they listened to heavy metal music and wore black, and one of them used to be a Wiccan. So what this film does, and you have Reese Witherspoon as the mother of one of the murdered boys, and Colin Firth as the extremely suspicious defense investigator who just thinks it's all a pile of baloney. And the town is being whipped up into this kind of hysteria, much like in The Crucible. You know, this becomes a witch hunt, and rationality flies out the window.
Are the parallels with The Crucible overt? Is it obvious that what he's reaching towards? Because that's some company to be placing yourself
in. It is, and it can't quite get there, to be honest with you. I mean, in fact, in some of the documentaries, we're talking about the Paradise Lost films and West of Memphis. The Crucible comparison is actually raised, and it's sort of obliquely raised in this film as well. But the problem is, you're opening lots of can of worms with this case. Cans of worms. You're sort of saying, well, but how about this? And what about this piece of physical evidence that the authorities completely ignored? And what about this extremely suspicious character they totally failed to interview? And all this stuff. And it's opening all these possibilities, but it can't close any of them off. So all you can do is create this massive area of doubt and say, you know, basically due process wasn't followed, and the guys did not get a fair trial, and that's sort of the end of this story, which is not enough of a story, I think. That's the problem here.
So on balance, worth seeing or not worth seeing, or would somebody unacquainted with the case be better off tracking down one of the documentaries first or instead of?
I would probably go with the Paradise Lost films as the best intro into the case. But it's not a terrible film. It's just slightly self-thwarting, because it's sort of taken this case and it's bitten off more than it can chew with it, really. Reese Witherspoon's pretty good. Colin Firth really is good. You need a level head to get you through the kind of craziness around the case, and Colin Firth's a good man to do that.
Okay,
so it's not bad.
We do have a clip from The Devil's Knot.
This crime is unthinkable. What if they did it?
And what if they didn't?
Some residents suspect a satanic cult is responsible.
My name's Ron Lax. I'm an investigator.
Did you kill any of those three boys?
No.
Those cops are scary. They will do anything to get people to say what they want to hear.
I'm acting right.
I'm not acting at all, Terry. Are you?
What the hell are you talking about?
These boys that you're helping, the police seem so certain. Are you sure you want to do this?
Yes, I am.
The police, the judge, everybody. This is all just some sort of game to them.
Would you want three more families to lose their children too?
A clip there from Devil's Knot, Atom Egoyan's interpretation of the events surrounding the West Memphis 3, the first choice of our film reviewer, Tim Robey. The next one you wanted to draw to our attention was Oculus. Introduce it if you would.
Well, this is if your kind of tastes run more towards genre thrills. This feels a little bit like quite an ingenious episode of The Twilight Zone or something like that. It's a low-budget American horror thriller in which an extremely old antique mirror essentially is this kind of evil totem which has driven every owner of it insane over the centuries into kind of homicidal rage. And a brother and sister whose parents suffered this exact fate decide to kind of finally bring an end to it and try and destroy the thing. But the thing is, it controls your mind as well, this mirror. So it's very difficult to destroy. It plays tricks on you and it kind of distorts your reality and you end up kind of running in circles around it.
Okay, well, we have a clip from Oculus.
Tim is a healthy adult who represents no danger to himself or anyone else. And I believe he should be discharged.
Hey, little brother.
I found it.
What do you mean?
We only have a few days.
A few days for what?
To keep our promise and kill it.
We were just kids. We made up a scary story so we wouldn't have to accept the fact that our father was a sick man who killed our
mom.
Why don't we just end it right now and smash the damn thing?
First, I intend to prove that the people I've just described were victims of the supernatural force that resides in that mirror.
You want to redeem the family name?
You promised me you'd never forget what really happened.
I was 10 years old.
Clip there from Mike Flanagan's Oculus. Is it actually scary? I speak as somebody who's probably not the target audience, as I tend to just get with thrillers, especially these sort of psychological thrillers about, you know, mirrors which have a personality, etc. I just tend to sit there thinking, this is a bit silly.
Yeah, it runs the risk of silliness. There's a kind of stupid version of this film which might have been made. This is actually the kind of slightly smarter version of this film. It's like the better end of X-Files or something, where, in fact, the brother and sister have totally different attitudes to the thing, and the brother is spending half the film saying, it's nonsense, what are you talking about?
So there's a Mulder versus Scully, skeptic versus believer
There
vibe.
Is a bit of that, and it's done quite smartly, I think. And actually, the shocks, the kind of scarier elements of it are played quite well. There is a very good scene where Karen Gillan from Doctor Who plays the lead. She's very good in it. She picks up what she thinks is an apple, but then suddenly she realizes it might have been a light bulb she just crunched down on, and her face starts bleeding and her mouth's gaping open, and then she realizes, no, maybe it was the apple after all, and the mirror has kind of totally tricked her. I think it works, but I think there's a problem at the end, which is that you've got a flashback sequence as well, in fact many of them, about the parents, and those go on too long. We kind of reach a point where we're done with that and we just want them to get on with it and get to the end, and instead we're kind of wrestling with the flashbacks too, and that just slightly overstays its welcome. It's slightly too long, about 20 minutes too long, I think. But not bad.
Okay, and we do finally, and quite tersely, unfortunately, have to move along to Belle, a new British drama by Amarasante.
So yes, this is about a mixed-race woman who was brought up as a noblewoman in the late 18th century, Dido Elizabeth Bell. It's sort of going for a Downton Abbey crowd and trying to slightly reinvent the period drama from within by having a woman of colour at the centre of it. And I think the lead performance is really excellent. Gugu Mbatha-Raw, her name is. She's very good. The film is very unsubtle, though. And it kind of feels as though it's hammering every point way too heavily on the head. Tom Wilkinson, who plays her kind of adopted father, is also the guy who managed to break open abolition in England by protesting against the terrible fate of slaves on the ship, and it's all a bit too convenient. It is a true story, but things have been massaged and differences there between the film and the facts, which I don't think help it.
That's Amarasante's Belle. All three of those films, Devil's Knot, Oculus, and Belle, in a Cineplex near you now or now-ish. Tim Robey, thanks for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thanks in particular to our special guests, Jane Kinnan-Mont and Nina Schick, at the top of the show. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Johan Lau, and our studio manager was Joel Church. After the headlines, we'll have The Menu with Marcos Hippie, then at 2200, The Monocle Daily with Emma Nelson and Ted Kravitz. This show returns at the same time on Monday at 1800 London time. But for this edition of Midori House, it's goodbye from me, Andrew Muller, and thanks very much for listening.
London. Tell Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
A Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.